You are Locked On Rockets, your daily Houston Rockets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
The swing game awaits. Hi, everyone, and welcome in to a new episode this Tuesday night here at Locked On Rockets, your home for daily podcast discussion of everything Houston Rockets basketball. As always, I'm your host, Ben Dubose, Rockets correspondent with Sports Talk 790, the team's official radio flagship in Houston. As we chat late this Tuesday, the Rockets are out again in Oakland, California. They, of course, tied the series up in Monday night's Game 4. We have a full recap in our Locked On Rockets archives wherever you listen to the program. Today, we're going to be spinning it forward to Game 5, which awaits late Wednesday night. And to help preview the key storylines, I am joined today by my friend Farouche Williams, a regular Locked On Rockets panelist who is based out in California and has a good up-close and personal view of the Warriors throughout the season. Farouche, how you feeling?
Pretty good, man. How about yourself?
I think everyone in the Rockets community is doing pretty well after last night. And heading into tomorrow, Game 5, it's a big deal. My initial thoughts that I want to bounce off you is that it's not quite as big as a lot of folks are making it out to be. Now, it's certainly a huge game, don't get me wrong, but I've seen a lot of narrative out there that Game 5 is the one that the Rockets have to get. And it could be. Obviously, the Rockets, to win this series, they have to win at least one at Oracle Arena, and they've only got two opportunities at the most left. So certainly, when you only have a sample size of two, one game can potentially be a very big deal. That said, with James Harden, Chris Paul, I fully believe this group is capable of winning a Game 7 at Oracle. We've seen the Warriors lose Game 7 to the Cavs. We saw last year in the conference finals, both obviously the Rockets, but also the Celtics in the East. They lost home Game 7s. So it's certainly not something that you want to bank on, but I also don't want to make it out to be where Game 5 is everything. If they have a competitive Game 5 loss, then all of a sudden I think there is optimism that you could compete in a Game 7 there and take your chances. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I mean, no matter how you look at it, we're going to have to win one in Golden State in order for us to win the series, right? I mean, there's really no way around that. I think the fact of the matter is that you cannot expect, realistically speaking, to beat these Warriors with Kevin Durant three times in a row. I don't think anyone's done it in the playoffs, and we've been doing some things that haven't been seen before, like beating them when Draymond gets a triple-double and beating them when Steph and KD both score 30 or more. But to beat them three times in a row in the playoffs would be a tall order. So I think I agree with you because the pressure is going to be on Golden State. Obviously, they don't want to be facing a 3-2 hole going back to Houston. And we've shown that we can hold our home court. We haven't lost at home in the playoffs yet, I don't think. And, you know, so, I mean, I think I'd be confident in our squad being able to come back, win a Game 6, and then you leave it up to Game 7, and anything can happen in a Game 7.
The Rockets actually have not lost a home game since March 13th. Now, that was against the Warriors, but it's been quite a while. So, yeah, they're playing well at Toyota Center. And one thing I mentioned going into the last question, the fact that all these games have been competitive, and certainly you don't want to lose by 30 points tomorrow, and I'm not conceding any loss at all. But if it's competitive again, how much credence do you put in the idea that the 2019 Rockets are better off than 2018 based on the fact that there have not been any blowouts? Because to me, that's a big deal. You look at a year ago, Game 1, it was at home, and you still lost by 13. Game 3, the first one at Oracle, they lost by 40. Game 6, I know that was without Chris Paul, but they ended up getting beaten by 30, even though they were up like 17 in the first half. This game, even the two at Oracle, when the Rockets weren't really playing that well, they were competitive. There's not been one game of the four in which the Warriors have outclassed them. So to me, as you look to Game 5 and Game 7, you've obviously got to win one if you want to win the series. I get a lot of hope from the fact that the Rockets, it's not like you're just flipping a coin and hoping that this is a night that you're making some shots. No matter who's hot, no matter if the shots are going in or they aren't, every single game in this series has been competitive. Maybe the Rockets have gotten even better than a year ago. Maybe the Warriors don't have that extra gear. But regardless, I take a lot from the fact that all four of these have been competitive, and I think that gives me more hope going into Oracle Arena. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, to kind of add on to that, I would think that, you know, the fact that it's been competitive throughout, added on to the fact that they're very top heavy and they've been running their top three, four, their top four guys into the ground with minutes. You know, I think everyone is averaging at least 39 or 40 minutes plus. And James Harden and Chris Paul are as well. But if Andre Iguodala is slowed down at all by this, you know, knee hyperextension, then that suddenly becomes a big deal. Because like you said, these are very, the games have been very competitive. So if Golden State loses just that edge, I don't think they have anyone to replace Iguodala other than like Alphonso McKinney. So something like that could really turn in this series. Whereas last year, I don't think it was until we were down 12-0, down 2-1 on the road where it kind of kicked in. And then, you know, we saw the Rockets kind of morph into a different team. And the series changed, I think, from that point, and it became hyper competitive. So yeah, I mean, I like where we're at. You know, I think the difference has been that last year I was confident in us being able to get a stop, and this year I was not through the first two games, and then, and even game three for the most part, I thought we were kind of trading punches. But game four, we finally showed that this group that we have can, you know, reliably get stops against Golden State down the stretch. And so carrying that momentum into game five on the road, I think, is very significant. So
you mentioned Iguodala, and particularly in the context of Harden, I think that's really the storyline to watch, because clearly, if you're going to win a game at Oracle, they're not going to go down without a fight. You're going to need Harden to probably be transcendent. You're probably not going to win a game at Oracle through your role players. You're going to need James Harden, Chris Paul, and of course, Harden as the MVP of the league to really take over, especially down the stretch. And you look at these two wins that they got at home. Obviously, Harden averaged nearly 40 points a game. And the Iguodala knee hyperextension, he is probable, but even if he's limited a little bit, that certainly helps. That happened on a play, a freak collision towards the end of game four. But even before that happens, you could start to see Harden figuring things out. Obviously, scoring nearly 40 points per game, but beyond that, he seemed more decisive on his drives, attacking the cup more. Iguodala last night was a minus 17, worst of anyone on the floor, shot just 3 of 9, so finally he started missing some shots as well. I'm just curious what it was that you saw James doing differently these last two games relative to the first two at Oracle. I won't say that he was night and day better, because especially game two, I know he had the eye thing early on, but he scored 29 points, shot nearly 50% from the field, so it wasn't all bad. But to me, he just looked a lot more decisive, and he looked like he was getting more comfortable throughout those two games in Houston, and it really culminated with that stretch early in the fourth quarter of game four when he just looked unstoppable. What have you seen from James Harden as far as adjusting to Iguodala throughout the series?
Man, what I saw is that he freed the step back, finally, right? It felt like it's been so long since we've seen the step back be just the bread and butter that it was throughout the regular season. Obviously, Utah tried to scheme the step back out. Mm-hmm. And then in game one, you know, James wasn't getting the whistle, and so the shot wasn't falling, and he was also getting fouled. So that was frustrating. But finally, I think we saw him free the step back. You know, he got that one call. I think it was in the first half. I think the second quarter, he got the call with Sean Livingston getting under his feet. Mm-hmm. And then he got the one with Clay getting under his feet. And I think at that moment, you know, I think once that shot went in, things changed for him and for the, just kind of for the game in general. But specifically to your point, in the fourth quarter, yeah, I think he figured it out, right? I mean, he just kind of toyed with Iguodala. I don't know if it was, it didn't look like it was fatigue on Iguodala's part. And I could be wrong, but I don't think he played, I don't know how many minutes he played, but I think it was less than the others, the other four. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was just kind of moving him whichever way he wanted. And I think it's because he started reaching into his bag of tricks. You know, we saw him do the spin move, step back from mid-range against KD. We saw him do the Euro, which we haven't seen him do that in a long time. But he just kind of felt comfortable. I think it's that unspeakable thing when a star player gets in a rhythm, and it's just kind of a combination of confidence and ability. And, you know, it just looked effortless, you know. He was dancing with them, dribbling whichever way he wanted. They don't have anyone in the middle to stop his floater. They don't have anyone in the middle to stop, like, the little Euro step that he did. So, I don't know. I think we kind of finally saw him at max power, just doing whatever he wanted. And we finally saw Golden State simply not have an answer for Harden.
Remember, to get this show every day, you can subscribe to Locked on Rockets on the new Himalaya Podcast app. In this ever-expanding podcast world, you need Himalaya with their personally curated playlist and new features each and every day. Download Himalaya at your app store and subscribe to Locked On Rockets. All right, jumping back in to our preview show for Game 5. This is Locked On Rockets. I'm Ben Dubose. Tonight we're joined, this is Tuesday evening, by Roosh Williams. And of course, we're looking ahead to the massive Game 5 on Wednesday night at Oracle Arena in Oakland, California. Rockets and Warriors tied at 2 games apiece in their best of 7 round 2 series. The Game 5 winner historically wins about 80% of the time in these settings. So it's a big game. We finished off our first of 3 segments talking about James Harden, the adjustments he made. And Roosh, I really like the points that you made about the carryover from the Utah series having some effect early on. I think with the floater, he fell out of rhythm because it was almost impossible for him to shoot that shot against Rudy Gobert. Then the step backs, the bizarre way that Utah, Rubio in particular, trailed him from behind, it was tough for him to get in rhythm. And then as this series has gone long, and of course the Warriors, they don't have Gobert, and they're not guarding him nearly the same way the Jazz are, then perhaps he's just getting back into rhythm. And if that's the case, then it bodes well, because one of the real debates of this to me is how much of it, what went right in Game 3 and Game 4, was the Rockets making adjustments and feeling things out, and how much was just the fact that they were at home? Because obviously to win this series, you're going to have to win one on the road. Well, the case that the Rockets, and Harden in particular, are starting to figure things out more and get more comfortable, then that's the kind of thing that you can take on the road. And as we were saying in segment one, you're probably going to need your stars to be stars to win at Oracle Arena. You're probably not going to be doing it with Austin Rivers and Iman Shumpert, those types of guys leading the way. So we looked at Harden already, but besides James, the two guys that might can take over a game at Oracle and do the type of transcendent performance that I was describing would be Eric Gordon and Chris Paul. We've talked about EG a decent bit this series, and even though he had a relative off night in Game 4, 2 of 12 from 3, he still scored 20, attacked well, and at the end of the day, it's just one game. He's still been really good overall, and it's actually kind of newsworthy that the Rockets won the game despite EG having an off night. But Roosh, the guy I really want to talk about is CP3. He shot just 4 of 11 in Game 4, but it felt like of his 4 buckets, they all came at really key moments. Chris had the strip midway through the 4th that led to the PJ Tucker dunk. He had the floater with about 2.5 minutes left that gave the Rockets some buffer before that final Warriors flurry. And then, of course, he had the rebound and the free throw that put the game away. I saw Nikias Duncan, a national NBA writer that I really like and have had on this show before, he referred to Chris Paul as very quietly the MVP of last night's game. At face value, you look at a guy who certainly had 8 rebounds, 5 assists, a couple of steals and blocks, but just 13 points, 4 of 11 shooting, that might seem like a stretch, but certainly at the key inflection points, it felt like he owned those. So my question to you is twofold. First, how would you assess Chris Paul's play in this series? And secondly, despite all the positives, does he still need to have a scoring breakout at some point to win either a Game 5 or Game 7 at Oracle?
So I think he's been playing very well. I think he's been playing like, I would say, like a fringe star. I don't think he's been playing like a complete, you know, all-star. I don't think he's been at the level that he was in the playoffs last year, but he's doing it in a different way, kind of in a more mature way. To me, I don't think he's looked hesitant, and he hasn't looked disabled, you know, or physically limited in any way. He just kind of looks like he's saving something, you know? Kind of mm-hmm. like he doesn't want to go all out and get spent like what happened last year. So I do think that we might see a Chris Paul breakout game. I'm not going to say that it's necessary for us to win the series, because I think we've proven that, you know, we have enough firepower. And if James and Eric are attacking the way that they do, and if we get, you know, some scoring from guys like Austin Rivers off the bench and a couple threes here and there from Shump, we can live with CP3 getting, you know, between 13, 15, and 20 points, somewhere around there, and an 8-7 stat line, something like that, right? But, yeah, I wouldn't go so far as to say he was the MVP last night, but he's been, I'd say, like I said, he's playing like a fringe star. He's playing great. He's doing what we need him to do. I think we've been leaning on Eric Gordon a little more in terms of scoring, and I think it's worked so far. So as long as we keep getting an aggressive Eric Gordon, you know, who's bullying guys like Steph to the rim and who's able to hit threes, I think he's shooting 35%. I think he's 16 of 46 for the series, kind of right around where he was, where he ended up at the end of the season. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think as long as we get that, we have a balanced attack that can do enough. I think it's more about, can we get stops reliably? Because in games 1 and 2, they went to Kevin Durant and he had his way. And in game 3, They got, you know, big shot after big shot. I think Iguodala hit two huge threes. But in game four, you know, when they needed buckets, we were able to guard them. And I think that what we saw in game four also that I wanted to touch on was James Harden might be one of our better, if not our best defender in spurts against Kevin Durant from the wing when he operates from the wing. And maybe we can talk about that more later. But yeah, so I mean, all these things considered, I think that we can live with the Chris Paul we've had. I think if we get Chris Paul breaking out, you know, kind of like he did in the closeout game against Utah last year, if we get a game like that from Chris Paul, then we might steal, you know, we can steal one at Oracle, I think. But I don't think it's necessary in order to accomplish that.
Yeah, and I had the defense, by the way, as next on my agenda to look at anyway. Obviously, Chris Paul's been pretty useful there as well. I think he's, just like last year, fared surprisingly well when he's switched on to Kevin Durant in a pinch. And at times, of course, you can see how he's really frustrating KD. We saw the elbow. But clearly, James has been the real revolution, the way that Harden has been able to defend Durant at times this series. And you look at the defensive turnaround. Clearly, the fact that the Rockets are getting more rebounds helps. They were an average of -8 in the first couple of games at Oracle Arena. These last two, they've been +13.5 on average. So you get more boards. That helps. PJ Tucker has been an animal. Clint Capella was at least a tiny bit better. He wasn't good, certainly not in game four, but he wasn't the massive liability he was in game one and game two. And they're also getting more comfortable, I think, playing that smaller Tuck Wagon lineup, which reduces the importance of Clint just a smidge as well. But obviously, it's not just the rebounding that helps, but they're doing other things. Mike D'Antoni, Jeff Bezdelic, to get better defensively as well. You mentioned Harden and Durant as one of them, but just curious what the changes you've seen on the defensive side as the series has moved along and how that translates to, as we were just talking about, winning a Game 5 at Oracle.
Yeah, so one thing I wanted to add real quick about Chris Paul that I think is kind of underrated is his rebounding. I think he's averaging just under 7 rebounds for the series. And given that, like you said, we were out-rebounded for the first two games and then we kind of figured it out, I think Chris Paul stepping up in that regard has helped a lot. As far as defense goes, I think it comes down to several things. One of those things is, the fact that Austin Rivers is playing. And I think Austin Rivers does a pretty good job of guarding Steph Curry.
Yep.
And we've discussed this before, his fast twitch ability kind of just helps him stay in front of quicker guards. And he didn't play game one, so I think that hurt. The second thing is, I think games three and four solidified our rotation. Games one and two, D'Antoni was kind of tinkering here and there. We saw some Fareed. We saw Daniel House, and I know House has been injured. We saw Gerald Green more in the first couple games, I think, off the top of my head, than we did in game four. I think he only played 3 minutes last night. So we finally saw like our 7-man rotation, who's it going to be? And I think that speaks to the defense because Shumpert is the 7th man. And I don't think Shumpert's been great. Obviously, he's made a lot of boneheaded plays. He missed a wide open layup at a crucial point yesterday. But defensively, I think he's the best option of the remaining, you know, people to fill that 7th man hole. I think he's better than Fareed, better than House, better than Gerald Green. And he also does some smart things, you know, like he's been finding smart cuts that other players on our team don't really find, like smart little back screens and cuts to the basket. Mm. And he's done nice things like setting screens to get people open for threes, just kind of the little things that don't show up in the box score. But the third thing that I think is the main, you know, underlying reason for the improvement in defense is, I think it's the Tuck Wagon, man. In the first half, with about 8 minutes left, we pulled Capella, and Capella didn't come back in. We went small the rest of the way. And I think Capella was pulled when we were down 35-33. And obviously we finished the half 61-54, would have been 61-51 if not for Andre Iguodala hitting a buzzer beater. So I think once we go small, since we've taken on the initiative to improve our rebounding, whereas in games one and two we were just kind of standing around watching the ball, expecting the shots to go in, going small obviously allows us to switch everything and stay in front of people. It prevents them from getting Clint Capella on either Steph or KD, and any little thing helps. And because of that and the ability that we've seen from PJ to step up in terms of rebounding, you know, I think that's kind of the recipe for what it's been.
And then you combine it with the offensive side and being able to consistently get good looks from three with that smaller lineup. It just works so well. What was really encouraging to me about the Game 4 win We mentioned earlier, Eric Gordon missed a lot of shots. He could get better than he played in game four. They still won with Eric as good but not great. But then specifically in the context of the defense, the way they tend to play, you mentioned Rivers on Curry, which is critical. The one downside, they're playing the three-point line, they're hedging, they switch so much, and they're doing a really great job of preventing not just three-point makes, but even three-point attempts. What looks the Warriors do get feel forced. I mean, everything is contested really well, so people look at the Steph Curry and Klay Thompson percentages. I don't think those are misleading at all. Now, you never know. Those guys are transcendent talents. Maybe Curry has an MVP showing where even if you guard him well, he still gets red hot in that building. It could happen. But generally, I think the percentages that Golden State shot in this series have been reflective of the quality of their looks. The one downside to that is that, of course, Curry has figured out that because of the way Rivers and other Rockets on the switches are defending him, then he's able to get more blow-bys. And game three, he missed a lot of those in the restricted area. Game four, that's how he had 30, and he had a lot better night aside from the threes, which were still well below his average. But the thing was, even with Curry scoring 30, and even with Durant having 34, you know, this was the first playoff game that the Warriors lost when each of those guys was at 30. The real issue was that even if those two guys, Curry and Durant, have success, the fact is, if they only have 8 threes and the Rockets have 17, then there's such a math problem. That's 27 points between those 9 extra threes that even if the Warriors do combat it by attacking the rim more, then ultimately the Rockets just have a math advantage. That's how I see it. So even though you look at it and say the Warriors counter, you know, they can attack the rim more and Curry did make more shots in the restricted area in game four than game three, then because the Rockets are still so effective at denying the three-point looks, generally speaking, it's a hard math equation for Golden State.
So I do agree with that. I would caution, though, that obviously when we go back to Golden State, who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, open looks will be sprung by moving screens.
yeah.
You know, and unfortunately, I do think that we are due for a Klay game. He has yet to go off, and game five at home seems like the type of scenario where he would go off. Some things could still be in play, but to your point, I mean, yeah, we're playing a defense that is, we're very cognizant of the fact that they shoot. And they shoot from anywhere. We have given up some open looks, but I think we're being selective of who gets the open looks.
Yes.
Meaning that it's going to be, you know, Iguodala or Draymond. And I think Iguodala is shooting 7 of 15 from 3 for the series. I think last night he was 1 of 4. So obviously, I'm not going to say that they go as he goes, but he's a big piece of what they do. So if he's making open looks, then, and that 1-3 that he did make, by the way, I think was the buzzer beater. So, but if he's making open looks, then it's going to be difficult. But if he's not making open looks, then I think that, you know, obviously it's going to shrink things. And we have been doing a good job of running them off the line. Klay, I think, I can't remember, I think Klay hit 2 3-pointers last night. And I know for sure that one of them, Klay actually hit 1 3-pointer last night.
Yeah, he had a couple that were right on the line.
Okay, yeah, the one on the line from the corner. The one that he hit that was actually a three, he had Capella in his face. And it wasn't necessarily bad defense by Capella. He was a little further back than he should have been, but, you know, he needs that cushion because of his foot space and because of his foot speed or lack thereof. And Capella had a hand up for the contest, and Klay hit a good shot. But that was his only make of the night, you know? So, yeah, I think, like I said, I think game four, we finally saw the Rockets, this iteration of the Rockets, show their capability to get a stop reliably. I think that's what was missing from the first three games. Like I said, even game three, it just felt like we were trading haymakers, trading big shots. But it looked like we finally figured it out defensively, and I think that's a product of going to the tuck wagon early in the second quarter to spring that run, solidifying the rotation with a defensive-minded guy in Shumpert instead of opting for something more offensive-minded like Fareed or Green, and Austin Rivers also being available.
Final thoughts. This is Locked on Rockets. I'm Ben Dubose. Today we're joined on our Game 5 preview show this Tuesday night by Roosh Williams. We've talked a lot about the Warriors in our second segment. Here in the third, as we close it out, just curious your thoughts on what the Warriors might do differently back in Oakland for tomorrow night's game. And is there a lever that Steve Kerr has left to pull in terms of a major adjustment? Or are we at a point now where these two teams You know, they played, I believe, 17 times the last couple of years with Chris Paul playing, and these two teams at full strength, they know each other so well. I'm just not sure how many major adjustments with the personnel there are left.
I really think at this point, these two teams know who the other one is. And I just think that's kind of what it is. I don't see what Steve Kerr could do unless, you know, Alphonso McKinney or Quinn Cook unexpectedly have a big showing at home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's kind of all I can think of. I don't think Jordan Bell is an option. I don't think Andrew Bogut is an option. Kevon Looney's been pretty much their only guy off the bench to play, you know, real minutes. He's been fine. But, yeah, I don't think Sean Livingston is going to do anything spectacular. And you could go down the whole roster and say the same thing. So I don't think they have a lever left to pull. I just think that they have, you know, we've kind of gummed them up. We've kind of gummed them up and thrown them off rhythm. So I think the best thing they could do is shake that, which would require defensive mishaps or defensive lapses from us. So if we start doing stupid things, you know, if guys blow coverages on switches and leave shooters wide open at home, you know, they could get going in a hurry and the game could be out of reach early. It could be that simple. But I don't think that there's like a tactical move or, you know, chess piece that's left in the bank. I think we kind of know what they are. And like I said, if Iguodala's hurt to any real degree, if he's fine, then we're going to see the series continue as it has been. But if he's hurt to any real significant degree and he's hobbled or limited, then I think I'm not going to say they're in trouble because I'm not going to count them out until they're out. But they're going to have to play really good basketball. And we're going to have to play bad basketball for them, you know, to comfortably win the game. And I don't want to bank on Andre Iguodala being injured. You know, I went back and watched what happened, and he seemed to move fine right afterwards, which could have been a product of adrenaline and whatever, because the reports I read from the Bay Area reporters were that, you know, he was noticeably limping and had a heavy ice pack on it. So, but, yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be that simple. If he's healthy and he's good to go, then we're going to see a back-and-forth game, and one team's going to pull away at the end, or we're going to see another close one come down to the wire like we have been. If he's hurt, then I don't think they have a move in the bank to go that could remedy that.
Last question for you. Aside from Iggy, aside from the Warriors, what's the one or two biggest priorities for the Rockets in Game 5? And this can be a player, it can be a matchup, it can be a statistic. Just curious that when you're looking at this, if they're going to pull this off, what are one or two things that really need to go right?
One or two things that need to go right. I'm going to throw one in there that doesn't count because it's a general thing, and that's obviously that, you know, we have to be aware of our defensive assignments because you can't lose sight of shooters. Like D'Antoni says, they got to feel us, right? And I think what he means by that is you can't lose your guy. You got to be in his face, in his grill at all times. So assuming that that happens, then one or two things that could help. I think one, I think we need I don't want to call it an Eric Gordon game, but I think we need Eric Gordon to, you know, have one of those games where he's hitting his threes, he's answering every run with a big shot, he's being aggressive. And by the way, we haven't spoken about Eric Gordon being tremendous on defense.
Good point.
And I think that deserves a ton of credit and mention. I think that has a lot to do with Klay Thompson having difficulties. I went back and watched the game, and even, like I said, of Klay's, I think, 15 points, five of them off my memory, or actually seven of them. One of them is the three-point shot over Capella that was contested. One of them he gets on a curl where he gets the ball at the top of the key on a curl, and then he drives to his left to the hoop. And there was a miscommunication between Gordon and Capella, and it looked like Capella's fault. So Capella was late on the switch, and Klay scored. And then the other one was a wide-open shot from the corner that we discussed earlier where his foot was on the line. So 7 of 15 points are those. I can't remember what the other eight are, but credit to Eric Gordon. He's been in his face, in his grill, you know, playing tremendous defense, and I don't think that enough people have focused on that. So, but yeah, if we could get an Eric Gordon game where, like I said, he's hitting big shots and answering every big run, and if we can get P.J. Tucker to continue to rebound the way he's rebounded and to continue to hustle the way he's hustled, and I'll put a slash on that second point, if we can get the Iman Shumpert that we saw in games 3 and 4, then I think we have a good chance. I think Shump was 4 of 7 from 3 in Houston, and I think he was 1 of 8 from 3 in Golden State. Obviously, you know, that can make a huge difference. So if we can get the Shump that we saw, who was, you know, setting off-ball screens to get shooters open, chasing down plays to keep the ball alive. There was one sequence in the second quarter, pretty much sprung our run wide open, Harden had just hit that three over Clay, and he got fouled for the and one, missed the free throw. Warriors go down, they missed the shot. Draymond was right under the basket. It looked like he had an easy rebound for a putback, and Shump makes a hustle play and jumps, tips the ball. We get the rebound, and then he comes down on the other end and drills a three from the top of the key to make it 47-39. And that kind of changed the game. And you're not going to see that show up in a box score. You're not going to hear it spoken about, you know, by reporters or whatever. But if you kind of go back and watch it, you see, like, that was the moment, you know? Yeah. Harden hitting that three was huge, and then boom, that was the moment, and the game was different from that point on. So if we can get contributions from that, like that, from role players across the board, the guys I mentioned, and then obviously we're going to need Harden and CP3 to show up, then I think we'll be in good shape.
I actually think, speaking of Shumpert on the offensive end, the most underrated stretch of Game 4, right at the end of the third quarter, the Warriors
had the mid-range shot.
Yep, the mid-range shot, followed by the Harden step back. Now, you would expect the Harden step back. You would not expect the Shumpert mid-range from 16, but that's what pushed it from 4 back up to 9. And, you know, the way I look at it, you're playing the Warriors, you're constantly trying to put out fires. When they go on a 6 or 7-point run, you're always worried that that's going to turn into, you know, a 15-0 spurt and Durant's going to get on fire like he did. And it felt like late in the third quarter that it was going to turn out the same way Game 3 did, that the lead's going to evaporate and it's going to come down to, as we said earlier, landing haymakers. And in this one, the Rockets, because Shumpert and Harden answered back, they played the majority of the fourth quarter with a pretty comfortable lead. And even though things got a tiny bit hairy at the end, well, when you're playing from largely up 10 or so points most of the quarter, things have a way of working out for you most of the time. So I thought that Shumpert mid-range, it's a little thing, but I'm right there with you. There were a couple of things that if Shumpert gives you that in Golden State, you have a heck of a lot better shot than you did in Game 1 and Game 2.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I mean, it was 86-82, like you said, and I, to be completely honest with you, when he took the shot before it left his hands, I thought, great, he's going to miss this, and like, the meltdown, here it is,
right.
It's here. You know, and then it went down, and, you know, like you said, we pushed the lead back up. And like you said, Golden State's going to make runs, but they're going to run out of gas, too. If you let them, you know, if you help them by continuing to miss shots and take dumb shots, then it's obviously going to spell doom for you. But, yeah, Shumpert hitting that stopped the bleeding and, like I said, changed the complexion of the game. So,
no doubt. Folks, he's Roosh Williams. You can follow him on Twitter at Roosh Williams. And, of course, we'll have him back throughout the playoffs. Hopefully they extend for a few more weeks now. We'll have to see. The Rockets have a lot of work ahead of them for that to linger on. But regardless, whether the Rockets have games or not, we'll definitely continue to have you on here at Locked On Rockets. Roosh, thanks so much for the time, buddy.
Sounds good, man. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Good stuff there with Roosh Williams. And I thought we hit on a lot of really good points tonight. Don't want to go on too long because we're now about 24 hours away from Game 5 actually tipping off. So until after Game 5, and we'll have our normal post-game recap, this is where we will break. If you want more content before that next episode, the best place to get it is on Twitter. I'm on there at Ben Dubose, simply my name. Roosh is on there at Roosh Williams, simply his name. And the show is on there at the handle Locked On Rockets. Be on Twitter. If that's not your thing, email LockedOnRockets@gmail.com, Facebook at Facebook.com/LockedOnRockets, the website LockedOnRockets.com. All those are ways you can access prior content. You can interact with me. You can ask me questions about the team, make suggestions for the show, advertising inquiries, anything we can do to improve this experience for you as simply a fan of the Rockets or even as a human being. Please don't hesitate to reach out and let me know. As always, thanks for listening. And beyond listening, remember that you can subscribe to this show on the new Himalaya Podcast app, as well as Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and Spotify. And when you get in your car, you can get our most recent episode that way as well, simply by telling your smart device to play podcast Locked On Rockets. Beyond listening and subscribing, if you'd also be kind enough to leave a 5-star review, that's how we can look attractive to potential advertisers and really keep this business model rolling as the only daily podcast covering Houston Rockets basketball. So for tonight, on this Tuesday evening, this is where we leave off. As always, thanks so much for listening. Thanks to Roosh for joining us. And please come back soon, Thursday morning, that is, for our next episode, breaking down Game 5. Hopefully, it'll be the Rockets taking a 3-2 lead, and we'll be looking forward to a potential closeout Game 6. How amazing would that be? I know the odds are against them. The Warriors at home, that's going to be a very tough game to win. Whatever happens, though, we'll be breaking it all down right here at Locked On Rockets, your home for daily coverage of everything Houston Rockets basketball.